Dan Partridge is a research associate with the Jazz Loft Project at the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University. His work as an audio specialist with the Jazz Loft Project explores the many stories that were documented on reel-to-reel tape by photographer W. Eugene Smith while living in a loft building in Manhattan's Flower District between 1957 and 1965. Dan serves as primary listener, that's a great title, to Smith's immense archive of reel-to-reel recordings made in this loft. He enjoys the challenge of trying to piece together their meaning as documents in terms of the lives that intersected in that loft space and how they relate to a larger story, which I'm sure we're going to hear this morning as soon as the computer is set. While they're doing that, let me use the time to also introduce Chris Lisinek. Chris is the founder of the New York-based consulting firm Audiovisual Preservation Solutions, or AVPS for short. Chris helped establish the preservation reformatting efforts, and he serves as an ongoing technical advisor to this project, and he'll discuss some of the technical aspects of the Jazz Loft Project. He's also likely to talk about what the project means to archives and to advocacies, and he may even meander into sharing some personal experiences of having worked on this amazing project. Having introduced both, I'll let Dan seg into Chris when the time comes.
About 7 or 8 years now, and started full-time when we got this collection transferred to digital format. It's the first time I've been invited to talk about the project. Usually Sam Stevenson, the director of the project, speaks. And so if you'll bear with me, I'll get started here, and I'm going to try to zip through his PowerPoint presentation as fast as I can and make more room for samples of audio, which I've brought along with me. We've got a collection that was recorded in this building, the building on the right, the three windows. It's a five-story walk-up. This door at the bottom used to be open to the street, and musicians and the people who lived there and worked there would walk in and have to walk up these creaky stairs. Very dark, run-down building. W. Eugene Smith moved in 1957, and between 1957 and roughly 1965, he made 4,000 hours of audio recordings on reel-to-reel. That's an estimate. He made 1,740 reels of tape that we were able to transfer, one reel that they were not able to transfer, and we have that now on, roughly 5,000 CDs, 5,089 CDs, which we have as listening copies. The work was, I've gotten through about 3,000 of the hours with some help from some interns and work studies, so a little frazzled. It's been 7 years of listening. I'll try to catch up now. But we have Chris Lisinek here, who was the first engineer to work with us when he worked at Vidipax. Of course, now he's at Audio Visual Preservation Solutions. And it's an honor to be here with him and with all the other presenters. But let me go ahead and give you some background on the project. The collection is actually held at the Center for Creative Photography in Tucson, Arizona. Sam Stevenson, who's director of our project, was working on research about the photographer W. Eugene Smith. When he discovered these tapes in the archive, they had housed them there since the late 70s, like about 1978, when Smith moved out there from a building close to this one after he had lived here from about 1957 to 1972. We were fortunate that Ansel Adams helped Eugene Smith move his collection to Center for Creative Photography because after being in this building with poor heating and air conditioning, I've been up there and in the summertime it gets to be about 140 degrees if the windows are closed. they wouldn't have survived if they hadn't been there. But because it was so expensive to transfer the tapes to digital format, and at the time of the first 300 reels being transferred, we had to also transfer them in 2002 and 2003 to reel-to-reel copies as well. And we had to shop for refrigerators and go to Sears and buy refrigerators and put the preservation copies in there for CCP. So anyway, we're lucky to have these reels. But Sam discovered them in cardboard boxes. It took several years for him to raise money to have the reels transferred. And while we were waiting for that to happen, we began with the names of the musicians that W. Eugene Smith wrote on the boxes of these reels in his chicken scratch handwriting, and calling them, doing oral histories with them, trying to piece together the story before we actually had the recordings. So I'm going to go ahead and jump into this a little bit. And it's just an example of one of the reel-to-reel boxes. These are the notes that Smith wrote on the boxes. As you can tell, there wasn't a lot to go on sometimes. The first reel we popped in, we did have some names of people, but December 59 or January 60. I'm actually going to play one from there in a minute, from that exact juncture, but another reel box. Before we get started with the talk, since we're in New Orleans, we had a reel that I found. There was one party that was recorded, one giant party. Usually it was a jam session in this building, but this particular night was a New Year's Eve party, and maybe because of this party being so out of control, I think they moved a piano up the stairs during the middle of the party. It was pretty crazy. There was a band playing with Roswell Rudd, Peter Inn, Dick Sutter, Nat Pierce, and others. And in the middle of this, New Orleans musician Danny Barker shows up with a banjo and plays this piece just really off the cuff. It sounds like he unpacked his banjo while they were yelling at him. So I'd like to go ahead and play that, track one, and just you could roll that.
Go ahead. Go ahead. Thank you. Beautiful, Danny. Beautiful.
All right, so you hear the band come in at the end, but before he started playing the banjo, it was really chaotic. It's really fascinating to be listening to this terrible chaos and then have a moment of clarity. This party that took place, I guess, December 31st and way into January 1st, 1960, was pretty wild, and it was on several different reels of tape that I didn't know who the band was until I got to a later reel and was able to get someone finally listed the names out, but that doesn't always happen with this. So so anyway, we took this collection, these oral histories, Sam's work with W. Eugene Smith, which you'll see in a second, and we came up with, over the last 7 or 8, 9 years, this book, which just came out last fall, published by Alfred A. Knopf, a radio series, which was produced by Sarah Fischko at WNYC. It was a 10-part radio series. You can go to our website, which is another of our outcomes, and hear that. You can link to that. So I'm trying to find content today that's a little rougher around the edges that you're not going to find on the website, in the exhibition, radio series, or anywhere else for that matter. And so some of the tracks, we don't have the exact listing for the names, or there might be a little static on this one radio piece I'm going to play, but no one else has heard this before since it, you know, was made, as far as I know. So we have that. We had an exhibition, which is closing Saturday at the New York Public Library for Performing Arts at Lincoln Center, and that produced a couple of public events. We had a movie that was made. Jason Moran came and listened to our Thelonious Monk reels that we have in the collection and sampled some of that and recreated in his own way a concert called In My Mind, which was based on the 1959 Town Hall concerts that are pretty famous. That was in 2007 at Duke where he first did that, and then in February of 2009 on the 50th anniversary he, you know, recreated that at Town Hall like 50 years later after Monk did. And we also had a big band, Charles Tolliver's big band, came and played that concert straight from the charts, and so we've worked with them as well. We have the website, which I mentioned, and a lot of other outcomes, which you can see on our website. I don't want to waste too much more time talking about this stuff when I have several more tracks that I'd like to share. So I want to get to that as quickly as possible so we don't run out of time. Franz, if you want to take this book, it's yours. And I wanted to draw attention to this piano because in the loft, one reason why the musicians came to the loft was because at one point in time there were four tuned pianos in the loft. There was a baby grand, there were a few stand-up pianos, and they kept them tuned. So with that and the people like Ronnie Free, who you'll see later, drumming in the loft, it was an attractive place to come late at night because you didn't have to lug your piano around and carry it up the stairs. You could just walk in and play. After these recordings were made, I think in the late 60s, Ornette Coleman supposedly came up and would compose on the piano up there and play around with that. Unfortunately, we haven't found that recording. What you see now is a list of names that one of the interview subjects gave Sam Stevenson when he walked in to do an interview one time. He handed him this and said, "These are the people I remember being in the loft." And the reason we like to show this list is because it shows that there were people like Eric Dolphy and Chick Corea who came up there, Elvin Jones, and then mixed in with those people in the sessions or not. You had people who are pretty obscure. Tom Wayburn is not recorded very much. Lynn Halliday had a little bit of a comeback but was not recorded very much in the 50s and 60s. And you can, I mean, people know these names. Sonny Clark, he's kind of in between. Gil Coggins. So there's one musician who's not on this list who was actually a schizophrenic guy. He was a musical genius. His name was Eddie Listengart. And we have a recording of him playing with Clifford Jarvis and some other people. And I think it's February of 1964 or late 1963. We weren't able to date it and identify all the musicians. And that's one reason why it hasn't been put out there yet. But I'd like to go ahead and play track two. And y'all can read these names and think about the way these musicians mixed up there in the loft. All right, so he was committed sometime shortly after that solo, maybe, I don't know how many months or days, but that's like the only recording of this guy playing. It's like this and another tape that we have. We have another couple of him talking to somebody about issues of race and different musicians like Charlie Parker and how he was a Pied Piper. But other than that, this guy's never been recorded. And we interviewed his cousin. We couldn't track anybody else down, but his cousin talked about how he could pick up any instrument as a child and play it. And this is like a great musical mind that would have been lost to the world if we hadn't have found these reels. So, W. Eugene Smith, the photographer who made the recordings, he was it's kind of a glamour shot. He wasn't always quite that together. Another reel. Here's some of his work. He was famous. He dropped out of Notre Dame and went to New York to be a photographer, and was famous for being in World War II and taking photographs on the front line. He jumped up one time when a bomb exploded and was actually hit by shrapnel, and later I'll show a photograph that was his comeback photo. He's called the master of the photographic essay. He photographed the country doctor. It's one of his famous Spanish village. This is an interesting slide. There was 12 to 15 images in this layout that was in Life magazine, but he took 1,000 pictures. So even early on, he would really immerse himself in his subject matter and research it. And I think that has something to do with why he made so many recordings. Nurse midwife. This is a South Carolina nurse midwife who worked basically around the clock, adopted kids, delivered babies, and did all sorts of stuff. And Smith really felt a kinship with this woman. And I think that his photography reflects that kind of personal attention and round the clock. This is Pittsburgh. My colleague Sam Stevenson found these recordings while he was researching the book, The Pittsburgh Project, and this is one of the master prints from that. More Pittsburgh. He was supposed to go there for 3 weeks in like 1954 and do a short essay on Pittsburgh. He wound up going there for like 4 years off and on and making, I don't know how many pictures. He thought it was going to be like the magnum opus of photography. And that kind of led to him leaving Life magazine and going to this loft building. So this is like 1954 to 1957 before he moved into the building. And there's the building. But I'd like to go back and play track number 5, where he's talking about the moon over Pittsburgh and like how he researched Pittsburgh so well that he knew like these nuances of photography. And I think that'll apply to the recordings as well.
Conflicts, contradictions, suggestions. On the next page, the love turns into a touch of a man and a woman in a dance, just holding hands, which again, I just wanted not as a great photograph, a great statement. I don't care whether they saw the photograph or not up there in the corner. I just wanted them to kind of feel it. As we talk more about the city, and repertorially, I wanted to say, look, the skies are clear. You can now see a moon occasionally in Pittsburgh without it being a depressing thing. And here, I think, is where it's kind of important at times to know enough about the background, say, to know that at one time. Can you imagine someone who has always been romantically involved with the moon, and just has loved it, whether they're on a farm or a city? Would they ever realize or take in their artistic consideration that a moon over Pittsburgh could have at one time meant real hardship, etc., because a moon over Pittsburgh meant that work was not happening at the plants, and therefore you saw the moon, you were immediately depressed because you knew it meant hunger and hardship, and the moon takes on a different connotation. But you've got to know that before you can utilize it in the layout and before you can think about it. And so the whole thing started developing from those first three pictures, you see, until love kept developing, the other things kept developing in that way. And so Thompson said the layout was a mishmash.
All right. So one of the benefits of listening to all this tape is that I kind of get to pick up on this great man's speaking habits a little bit. But that's Eugene Smith talking about the moon in Pittsburgh. The loft building. This is a picture Eugene Smith made of the loft. He took a lot of pictures out of this window that you see up at the top. That's his camera and a broken window. And he photographed the street. So hearing about him being so intent on researching Pittsburgh, you can see where he decided to maybe make 1,740 reels of tape and 40,000 photographs in this building. Here's a collage of tape boxes that Chris's colleague Matt Thompson at Vidipax back in 2003, I guess, probably took a lot of the tape boxes and made this collage. It's kind of fun to look at. It's in the book as well. Map of New York City. The loft, as you can see, is kind of in the middle of New York, and it's in the Flower District. It's kind of at the top of the Flower District and under the Garment District. The elevated train used to ride over there. It was taken down in like around 1929 or 30. It was easy to get to if you had a show uptown, downtown, wherever you were coming from. People could get there pretty easily. And we have a lot of oral histories where people are talking about coming out of the loft at 6 in the morning, this kind of romantic notion of smelling the flowers as they came stumbling out of the loft building after playing jam session all night. But it's that black dot in the middle, for those of you who aren't familiar with New York. That was also the Tenderloin District. I think one reason why this area was zoned for not for housing and the loft was able to sustain itself over all these years, because there were lots of jazz lofts, or lofts where people played jazz in New York, was that there was a wake. It was kind of a dead spot. One of the flower shop owners told us it was a dead spot in the middle of New York. And I think that's because the Tenderloin District was there. There was these brothels and gambling houses and dance halls and crime and with the elevated train. It took a while for that neighborhood to finally get zoned for housing, and then just now it's starting to get gentrified. It's going to disappear, and the Flower District is kind of drying up around it. Here's Smith in the loft. Kind of not a glamour shot so much. I think because of his war injury to his face, he self-medicated with alcohol and uppers, which were not used for recreation but for work and for making these recordings and working while he made these recordings. Here's Zoot Sims with an unidentified woman. I guess this is at one of the parties in the loft. We have a lot of recordings of Zoot Sims. You can go to our website and hear some really good ones. I didn't bring any of Zoot today because they're already out there. Pee Wee Russell, Vic Dickinson, and the guy by the door is Ronnie Bedford. This is outside of the, they have these hanging light bulbs in the hallway. They had wired it for electricity. Here's Roland Kirk. You notice the guy with the pipe, that's Paul Blay, and that's actually Patty Waters, who's a singer. She's on the couch listening. We don't have her voice on the tapes, but we do have her in this picture by W. Eugene Smith. What I'm going to play now is a recording where Roland Kirk is in the loft playing with another saxophonist, Jake Cameron, and it's real short. I'm only going to play his solo, but he starts the song by counting off the cadence for Jake Cameron and singing the song to him while he plays it. And then later on, Paul Blay comes in at the end of this song, like shows up and starts playing the piano, which was just sitting there waiting for him. But in the meantime, we have on track number four from January 4th, 1964, Jimmy Stevenson, who's a loft resident, on bass, Paul Blay on piano later, who you won't hear, Edgar Bateman and Eddie DeHaas with Roland Kirk. Go ahead and play that. I'll scroll to another couple pictures.
Thank you.
So since I'm short on time, I'm going to flip through here. Here's Smith at his cracked window. Pictures of the street, which are beautiful. You can see these on our website. That's Freddie Redd, Thelonious Monk, who worked in the loft with Hall Overton to arrange collaboratively, with Monk's guidance, the charge for the 1959 Town Hall concert. We have a lot of those. And you can go to our website and hear a whole radio show on that. So I didn't bring any of that. Hands. Street. Jimmy Jufri, Pie Man, Monk, and Hall Overton. Hall Overton had a studio in the loft from 54 until his death in 1972. I said that he worked with Monk. He played. We have tapes of him playing. And this next thing is from 1963. It was a summer series that took place at the New School. He taught lessons to everybody from Steve Reich to people you never heard of before, to Doris Duke. And this next thing is something that he worked on in the loft. This is him interviewing Sonny Rollins. And this is track number 6, June 29th, 1963.
Camps and so forth. Now, they would sound similar to this. Colorful effect, and it's developing a new aspect to the tenor saxophone, and it can be used, as you're proving, very expressively. I heard some of the sounds. I heard the bass on the fifth here, some on the octave. Could we hear? Did we try going up a little bit on these?
They talk a little bit more about that. I'm going to play one last track. That's Ron Free, who lived in the loft, and that's another one you can hear about on the radio series. Jimmy Stevenson lived in the loft. He just passed away right before the book came out, and it was really validating for him. He was another musician who was really into music, then went and lived in California, made wind chimes, but it was really validating for him and his family to have this book come out on the radio series right before his death, and be re-remembered that way. That story happens a lot. You can read about some of that stuff on the blog. I'm going to end with one more track while we change computers out, if you could let it roll for a while. It's the seventh track. This is Sonny Clark in the loft. He died in January of 1963. This is from September of 1961. He only recorded...
Seven.
But not yet. So he died shortly after that. He only cut one record as a band leader after this. He was revived by one of the loft squatters who didn't live in the loft but in the hallway, his girlfriend. And so if that hadn't have happened through this make-do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, he wouldn't have gotten to that record and some other ones as a sideman. But this is Sonny Clark from 1961, and I'll scroll through the rest of the images while this plays, and then we can trade out computers. It's the end of a song, and then he just goes off into this song. These moments happen throughout. Dave Young, loft president. That's Eugene Smith. They called him the Shadow. Lamont Cranston was the alter ego of the Shadow. You can see all his cameras around his neck. And a cartoon similar to the one we saw in the first presentation, maybe. You can interpret it however you like. Mm-hmm.
Hello, everyone. How you doing? It's a hard group to follow, especially since I'm going to be talking about technical things. I hijacked the content side of the equation, and I'm going to talk about some technical things. So first off, I have to say it's been an amazing experience and such a pleasure to work with Sam and Dan over the years. And I really think this collection could not have found better advocates and support. They've done an amazing job of really preserving and making accessible this amazing collection. The background here that I'm using for my presentation is the actual floor of the Jazz Loft itself, and that's meaningful to me and probably Dan as well. Just that the Jazz Loft itself takes on such a character in these recordings you hear. Obviously, there's the signature of the space acoustically as you hear in the music, but aside from that, one thing that Sam Stevenson points out, and I think is a really great observation, is that the really amazing thing about one of the really amazing things about this collection, and this is a big statement given everything that we know about this collection, is not just the amazing music that we hear, it's the in-between moments that make this such a meaningful collection. We hear there's so much downtime. I mean, Eugene Smith was recording constantly. So you hear all of the silence, you hear the conversations. You know, people forget that there was recording going on. And over the thousands of hours of content, you get such a context in those in-between moments. And in those in-between moments, the Jazz Loft really comes to life as a character in this story, too. You hear the creaks of the floor and the doors and the sound of the space. And that's such a part, just as are those the tapes that we saw. And Dan showed us some great images. You know, the Jazz Loft is such a valuable and meaningful story to archives in general and to collections. It's a story that everyone gravitates to. It's compelling. It's inspiring. I literally have heard it on a number of occasions. I've been in the deli and just heard, you know, people on the street talking about the Jazz Loft project in New York. And it's something that really grabs people. And it's such an opportunity for everyone in this room and everyone at this conference to really tell this story and tell about archives and the success stories and in the face of all the challenges we face, it's such a great story to tell. You know, the story that we see in articles and that is the one that's so easy to talk about because we're all so familiar about it, are all the challenges, the lack of intellectual control, the lack of funding, all these things that we're all too familiar with. But this is such a great entry point into a conversation to tell people about the significance of archives, to talk about what else is out there that may exist like this. And that's important. It's also important to think about that in the context of working with in archives as far, you know, from an administrative perspective. This is such a great model and example to follow with regard to the things and the ways in which they've leveraged this collection that Dan told us all about. There's so many reasons that despite the content in this collection that these things couldn't happen. And there's so many collections on a day-to-day basis that you run into where they don't because of things like rights and politics and all kinds of things that come into play. And this is a great example of a project that overcame those challenges to really get this stuff out there. The phased approach to preservation and access, Dan showed us boxes with writing on them. A lot of boxes didn't have that. You know, they took a really smart approach. They took the low-hanging fruit, they digitized it, they raised awareness, they got people excited. They did that to raise more money so that they could then go back and preserve more tapes. So just a really smart approach to getting this project done and then getting it out there and getting people hearing it. Just a really amazing job. So I'll dive into the technical background a little bit. So as we know, it was all quarter-inch open reel, almost all 7-inch in diameter. The transfer process was established in 2002, and as Dan pointed out, it started as a tape-to-tape project. This was in the dawn of digital preservation for audio, and so for the first year or two of the project, we were doing tape-to-tape, which is interesting. So it added a lot of cost, that's for sure. So Over time, the project evolved to creating digital preservation masters besides all the CDs Dan talked about, which were the access copies, or also high-resolution files created. This was just the basic process we established for the preservation of this content, or these reels. And there's a, on the top right, we say simultaneous to tape. We did digitization, and we ended up having to do lots of stopping and starting. The tapes were, as I'll get into, just a wild variation of track formatting and speeds, and everything changed over the course of the tape. So we had to do lots of stopping. So in order to create the listening CDs, we did digital. We digitized to a digital audio workstation, and then did editing in order to produce the access copies. Preservation copies were made straight from tape to tape. But that was a very fortunate thing that we did that. And being audio engineers, and every myself and Matthew Thompson and a couple of other engineers, obviously we loved this project to death. Everybody wanted to work on this. And even though we were creating CD copies with this, fortunately we captured at a higher resolution. And later, we also backed it up, which was very fortunate years later when we were able to restore those. So we actually have, even when we were doing the tape-to-tape, we were able to provide the high resolution files. So we did a lot of documentation in this project as we were transferring. These are a list of fields that we were capturing. There was lots of IDs. There was the Center for Creative Photography IDs. The Smith had his own ID system sometimes. There's all types of dates that would come up. And we really, like I said, everybody was compelled to really take documentation to the full extent. So much so that, I think I can't remember exactly what our transfer times were, but it was somewhere in the neighborhood of 5 to 1. So for every hour of content, it was taking about 5 hours to do the full process, including just this initial pass at documentation, not to mention all the work that Dan has done since then. So that was just the first pass. We were capturing things when we were doing documentation that spoke both to the sonic issues that were part of the original recording, as well as degradation issues that occurred since. So this is just an example that I pulled out of some documentation that was done. So where we're noting abrupt starts and dropouts at the head, and all those things that are important when you're listening later, that you'll want to know if this was something that happened, that's happened since the tape was created or not. And then you even have some sonic, the peak drum levels are distorted, things like that as well, with some timestamps and things. So we have dropouts and clicks noted in here. And then also just the music, and what parts were music and what parts were dialogue. We made track markers and things to provide to these guys for being able to navigate through listening more to the content. So as Dan showed, there was lots of writing on the boxes. Some of that content included names. It included, you saw things, I think, on the snapshot of the back of the box, the good take, or use this, or don't use one side. So we saw lots of, I'm sorry, this is not on the box. This was actually in the recording. So as the tapes were playing, we were documenting names that were coming up and things like that. The equipment, which, basically we were using high quality equipment to do all the transfers, is the gist of this slide. The tapes were mostly polyester. There was some acetate. They were surprisingly in good condition. We found that there were not too many issues. As Dan said, there was one tape that we encountered that we could not transfer. And I should say that we actually, when I was at ViDiPax, we transferred the first 500 or so, I think, reels, 300, okay, 300 or so reels. And then I left ViDiPax, and sometime after that, the work went to Safe Sound, and they continued this work. So, but most of the ones we worked with were polyester. There was some acetate, great condition. There was the one tape we couldn't transfer that the oxide was literally, the whole layer was peeling off the back, and it was depressing because Monk's name was on it too. So we were smart enough to not take the chance, and it's being preserved now. I think that it would likely be a good idea to raise money to put some serious development work behind transferring that tape. So we saw it was mostly 1 mil, mostly 7-inch reels, if not 7-inch, then smaller. And brands were all over the place. One thing that was clear about Smith, and I think that these guys found when they interviewed people, he was extremely resourceful, and he was always upgrading his equipment all the time, and microphones and decks, and it was very clear he just would beg, borrow, or steal to be able to do, you know, to do this documentation. And this is the same slide that Dan showed, a better visualization of the variety of brands that we were dealing with. The track formatting speeds, like I said, were all over the place. So we'd have, you know, half track and quarter track, mono and stereo, unidirectional and bidirectional, and you would have multiple tape speeds. And here, this is just an example of documentation. So on side A, for the first 2 minutes, it was 7.5, then 6 minutes of 3.75, then 7 minutes of 1.875, then back to 3.75. So we had this lots of changes. All on one tape. So you'd have tapes that were quarter inch, 7.5 for 5 minutes, and then switch to half track and all kinds of crazy, wacky stuff, which added to the time that it took to really transfer this stuff with the integrity of the original recording. And Sam always talks, or I shouldn't say always, the last time he spoke, he mentioned that one person noted that Eugene Smith was always able to get people to do work, you know, would get people to work for him. And Sam smiled that, knowing that he is now doing a lot of Eugene Smith's work, and I think we were then too. We were now dealing with the work that he left behind for us to deal with, all that crazy track formatting and stuff. So the documentation on the boxes was variable. As I said, I thought it was a great idea that the prioritization for which reels to do first was based on that documentation. There was an obvious pitch to funders based on that. And then we saw some of the, this is just documentation of what we saw on some of the backs of these boxes, which, you know, so he was taking notes about great piano, trombone, bass drum, trumpet and sax, but also then some dates, and then talking about distortion, and even pointing to dialogue. It's just great that he's obviously so serious about documentation. He's saying aspire to have good small crowd urgings. You know, he's clearly had the sense he was going to be returning to this stuff and was documenting it to do so. The question mark here is actually on our end. This, you know, there's parts of this where we can't decipher what's on the box, which is a great. You know, I don't know if when we were doing this project back in 2002, we were not scanning the boxes. That wasn't really part of typical preservation workflows. I think that would be a very wise thing to do. I don't know if that's happened when it moved on to Safe Sound or not, but that's very valuable data to capture. And then there's things like this, don't use very good, but has Konitz, which, you know, could be interpreted in a number of ways. Dan's research, what I came to, I asked him about this, and Konitz was very conscious about what was released or what people would hear of his playing. So this was Smith's respect for Konitz's wishes not to have people hear what he was doing in the loft unless he, you know, explicitly said that it was okay. Just some more types of documentation. One best technically, both delightful, and then we even get a little bit of technical metadata in there. He tells us he's using a Norelco recorder and stereo. So like I said, you know, overall the tapes were in good condition, but the equipment was surprisingly in good condition, and we got the impression that, like I said, that he was always upgrading his equipment. He used lots of different microphones and microphone techniques. He had everything from, he would do things like drill holes in walls and you know, put 10 microphones and floors and walls and ceilings and all over the place to one microphone setups. He did all kinds of things. And it's interesting, we thought the quality was good, very surprisingly good most of the time. And And it was interesting because we kind of had the assumption that he was upgrading his equipment all the time, and that's what we heard. But I know in interviews there were people who said, no way, that the equipment he had was always junk. There's no way he was going to be putting money towards that stuff. So anyway, we ran into the typical problems, as you heard in some of those recordings. There's distortion, and then you have this really low, sometimes dialogue where people are sitting a number of feet away or across the room talking, and so you have some signal to noise issues and the typical things that you run into in field recordings, but overall very good. Then you have the things like we have here. This is a thing. It was cats meowing for 6 hours, or just street noise, or just nothing going on. And to some extent, that's interesting too, but not exactly what people are going to pay to preserve. It could be Monk in Overton or cats meowing. And I'd say that one of the most enlightening things from my perspective about listening to the tapes that I transferred was just the getting to hear Monk on these tapes in conversation. That was really enlightening. It showed him in a different light than some of the documentaries we hear. He's much more, he can be articulate and coherent, and comes off in an entirely different way than he's often than when we often see him in documentation. So, in closing, like I said, he put tons of microphones in the walls, and he captured this amazing story. I think that it's important that we all get out there and tell this story about this collection that was turned up, and that had been unknown, and be advocates for archives and collections and this type of work, and really spread the message on the importance of this. So thank you very much. Thanks, everyone. I appreciate it. Thanks to Jan.
Depends on the musician. There would be sessions where one guy knew it was being recorded, one had no idea. There was one tape I just found a couple of weeks ago or a month ago that Peter N., the bass player, was coming back to make some recordings from Smith's recordings of himself, so he knew about it all along. Monk obviously knew it. There was a picture of the recorder out there by the piano, and I think Holliverton used that to help him do the arrangements after Monk had given him the direction.
Musicians in these states let you use these?
For nonprofit usage. We haven't put out a CD that might be in the future, but it varies between each musician in each estate. Monk estate, we've had to be more formal with them, and they've let us use it for that Jason Moran concert, which talked about earlier.
Musicians are contacted.
If we use it, our attorneys that we talked to said not to contact every single musician on every single tape, but figure out which ones we were going to use and then contact them as we decide to use it.
What have the unions said?
Well, nothing.
Do they know?
Yeah, when it's used, there's lawyers involved, and they interact with the states and the musicians get paid so far. But a lot of the use so far, the radio series with WNYC, they did those things. And I don't think that they have to pay as a nonprofit station for this usage.
What are the New York laws on recording private conversations?
They're very complex. We spoke with an attorney, and I have several pages of notes on that. And if I tried to talk about that, I would be even less clear than I was earlier.
Because in many states, the recording of somebody's conversation is illegal, but taking a picture of them secretly is not. So,
right.
So sometimes the use of the sound, just people talking, is
yeah.
Problem.
And there's a lot more gray area than I even suspected, coming from a lawyer who was supposedly dissecting these issues. She spoke about the way that with fair usage laws, there's a lot of gray area, and there's like a certain year that the laws change. And in New York, it's principalities almost, or county to county sometimes, I think. Or in one state, it's like that. So it's pretty crazy, and that's one reason why we don't have a commercial product, the book with a music on it. The book doesn't have any audio. But you can go to our website and hear it, and we're not making money on that. You can hear it.
Did Smith listen to all of this later?
No, but some of it. Yeah, definitely not all of it. Because there was no time. He died in the time after he made it. And the amount of time that I've taken, he would have been dead. And he was constantly working. It was not a scene where people were partying. Most of the drinking and drugs were taking place while they were working. That's right. Yeah, he would go back and listen to a lot of the music stuff. But, like... No, the only... occasionally, but rarely. We do have issues with the reliability of the narrators that are doing the oral histories. Sometimes they'll lay claim or disclaim the usage of people that we know are on there because of their memory. It's hard to remember stuff, obviously, for all of us, like from last week. And it's an interesting dynamic to try to pit these notes against the sound, against... We have even, like, some jazz acts. Like, Paul Blay misidentified a song, and somebody else, like, when we put it up on the web, they said, no, it's not that song, it's this other song. And then they were right, he was wrong. So that sort of thing happens all the time. And in these jam sessions, the musicians were experimenting. They might play two songs instead of one song, or play a solo that ran through five different, you know, melodies at one point or another. And whatever clip that person hears is the clip they're going to attribute to the song, but the beginning of the song might be something totally different. Yeah, because in this setting, musicians were free to play as long as they wanted, and to the chagrin of the bass player and the drummer. Yeah. Anybody else? Thanks so much for staying and sticking through the talk. Really appreciate it.